It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about a new economic development program in Arizona called Velocity. Our guests will be Chris Camacho of GPAC and John Graham of Sunbelt Holdings. Plus, the Arizona Diamondbacks endured Major League Baseball's worst season in 2014, but 2015 has seen significant improvement. I'll talk with Zach Buchanan of the Arizona Republic about what's making the difference. Also, longtime Valley actress Kathy Dresbach, who was once a cast member on Wallace and Ladmo, has written a new play. We'll find out what moved her behind the scenes. We start today's program with the director of Arizona's Department of Health Services, Dr. Kara Crist. She had been the agency's deputy director and chief medical officer. Dr. Crist, welcome. Let's start with the headlines that include a recent unsatisfactory report about the state hospital that used the term serious deficiencies. How serious were these problems that were uncovered, and what is the agency doing to fix them?
You know, they were relatively serious. We were looking at the report. Luckily for us, we had gotten feedback at the end of the CMS survey. So when they came out and looked, before they left, they gave us a heads up on what some of the issues that they were going to put into the report. So at that moment, we started working on our corrective action plan. So how we were going to meet the requirements of the CMS contract. So actually, we turned in our CMS plan of correction. We're hoping it gets accepted in the next day or two. And then when they come back out, we hope to be fully in compliance.
So you're a longtime medical professional. You're also an administrator.
Yes.
So when it comes down to these issues, I presume it frustrates you on multiple levels. How are you able to get in there and not be, let's say, not be emotional about it, not be frustrated, but actually work toward solutions?
Well, exactly. So you look at it, this is a contract that we hold with the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. We've got new leadership in place that don't have the historical feelings and emotions about it. They know what they need to do to fix it. And, you know, our primary goal, obviously, is to provide excellent patient care and to ensure that our patients are on a road to recovery. And that's really what they're focused on.
Do the state's leaders, political leaders, elected leaders, whoever you want to talk about, is there a commitment? There's been a concern, of course, after the recession that every budget is tight. Does this agency need more support to implement the changes you want to?
You know, I feel that we've been very well supported, especially by this new administration and the administration previously. So we get a lot of support from our legislators, from the governor's office, and they are very understanding when we need something because they understand that in order to do appropriate health care, you should have good prevention and public health in place.
So are there certain things that and changes that if the headlines had not been out there with the state hospital, are there certain things that you have really wanted to implement, you've been able to, or things that are really closely watched in the docket that's going to be up next for Dr. Kara Crist?
Well, yes, I think that this allowed us to have an open dialogue with the governor's office. So that's very important. And it allows us to use this to really show how important preventive public health is and behavioral health in treating the whole person. And so one of the things that we're really working on moving forward is our Arizona Health Improvement Plan, which encompasses 15 leading health issues that have been identified from community and state health assessments that we're going to be working on moving the needle on in the next 5 years.
Interesting. Okay. Can you give us a couple of those?
Sure. There are things that probably come to mind to everybody. So things like obesity, behavioral health, heart disease, cancer, those things that really affect the population, but also affect individuals.
Behavioral health is one of those things which is, I think, a challenge for every medical professional, every administrator, because it's not one of the measurables. It's very difficult to say, you know when your broken leg is fixed, you know when other things are fixed. You're not necessarily sure with behavioral health. Does the state do a good job with that? Are there new ideas that are coming about that the state is going to embrace?
You know, one of the things that we've been working on over the past couple of years is really integrating behavioral health services with your acute physical health. So when people with behavioral health needs, we're not going to divide their care anymore. So they don't go see a mental health professional and then a physician. It really should be an integrated service because your physical health depends so much on your behavioral or your mental health.
In the role you have, one that is appointed by the governor, can you be a free agent at all? Or is there a certain philosophy that must rest with the administration? I mean, because you obviously have ideas of your own, very strong ideas, I would think, very strong opinions. But is there a way to balance that? Because I'm sure people want to hear And what does Dr. Kara Chris think? But you also don't want to go too far off the range, I would guess.
You know, they've been very, very supportive and kind of naming me the CEO of my agency, which is very refreshing. And so they've been very open to hearing ideas and supportive of the things that we've been moving forward on.
One of the big issues that the public was concerned about, measles at the time coming from Disney or Disneyland. Vaccinations in Arizona can be a little bit controversial, certainly in certain areas. So how do you increase the number of people getting vaccinated, the number of kids getting vaccinated? How do you make that a priority that also doesn't feel like government overreach to some?
Right. One of the important things to do is to reduce the barriers. So one, to increase the understanding and education to parents and to patients themselves on the importance of vaccine. It's while it protects you, by getting yourself immunized, you're protecting all of those around you, especially when it has to do with diseases like measles or pertussis that can kill newborns that may not be fully vaccinated yet. So that's really important. And that's our job to do, is to educate the public on that. But the other thing that we can do to help is to reduce the barriers. So, you know, making sure that it's easy to get your vaccinations and that there's convenient places to get them. A lot of people don't know that you can go to your local pharmacist and get a vaccine for certain things. And then so that we have the appropriate documentation at schools and child care centers when you enroll your children, making it easy to obtain those records to show that your child is fully up to date with immunizations.
Do you think the measles outbreak caused people to take it even more seriously than they did before?
I think they did. I think we have done such a phenomenal job of vaccinating and over the past couple of decades that I think we're not used to seeing some of these really scary diseases. And so when it comes, you know, everybody thinks, well, I go to Disneyland, my children could get it. It hits closer at home than when it's far off in another state.
Do you think there should be stronger regulations tied, as California has done, to sort of forcing people to get vaccinated?
You know, we'll probably be watching California very closely to see how that takes. I think that the first steps is always education, reducing barriers, trying to get people to do things on their own.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Dr. Kara Christ. She's director of the Arizona Department of Health Services. Dr. Christ, I've talked with your predecessor, your permanent predecessor, many times, Will Humble, who had a great history with public health but was not a medical professional himself. What did you learn from how he handled the job?
You know, working with Will was great experience, and so I've worked with Will for a number of years. He really has a passion for public health, and he is a hard act to follow, let me tell you. But you know,
I'm glad you said act instead of where I thought you were going there.
He's fantastic. And so, but one of the things that you really learn is how to bring stakeholders in and include them and also be evidence-based in your decision-making. So involving those who actually have access to the data and finding out what the data shows before making decisions.
One issue he and I discussed a lot was medical marijuana, and that was one that came up all the time. Is that an issue you're having time to tackle? How do you think the program has done so far in Arizona?
You know, luckily, in my previous positions with the health department, I've been very closely associated with the medical marijuana program. And I think that shows that, you know, the development of that program. Will did such a great job putting that program together and really involving the stakeholders and making something that truly is a medical program, but that can be regulated as well. You know, that was one of the first times that we've seen such stakeholder involvement. And I learned a lot about involving the stakeholders and partners in rulemaking and how important it is to make sure you've got adequate rules in order to regulate.
Do you have any concern about the competing ballot initiatives that are on the way to legalize recreational use of marijuana in Arizona?
You know, not so much from a department standpoint. So, you know, if that were to get approved by the voters and become, you know, some of the initiatives have it becoming its own agency, we would certainly welcome and partner with that agency to provide them with the resources we've already put together and, you know, help them with our experiences that we've had over the last 5 years.
Another thing that's popped up recently, because we had a wetter June than we usually get, is, of course, West Nile virus pops up. How serious an issue can that be in Arizona? And other than the idea of not having standing water on your property, that kind of thing, are there certain things people need to be aware of, maybe as relates to their kids, for example?
Well, you would want to make sure that you are taking precautions, just like you said, to avoid getting bitten by mosquitoes, because that's how West Nile virus is transmitted. You know, we are watching for other mosquito-borne diseases. There are other illnesses out there. And so, you know, getting rid of your standing water, not being outside, or if you are outside, you know, making sure you're using mosquito spray and wearing long sleeves, because it is very hard to go outside during the day and exercise. We completely get that, but making sure that you're taking appropriate precautions. Most people that get West Nile virus aren't going to have symptoms, but those 20% that do, it can be very serious, especially if you have underlying health conditions or you're very, very young or part of the elderly population.
The issue of valley fever pops up once in a while, but are there other public health issues that seem so tied to Arizona or to Arizona and the West that people may not think about quite as often?
Well, the other thing that we have in Arizona that's really important is heat-related illness. So especially at this time of year where it's very, very hot, you're going to want to have plans in place. So if you're going out, make sure that you have adequate water, that you know where you can stop in case you need to cool off. And if you've got either elderly family or neighbors that are on medication that may make them more susceptible to heat, you're going to want to have a plan in place to make sure that you're checking in on them so that they're okay too with the heat.
And we've certainly seen some people with hiking getting caught up there, obviously having health issues. And that's not always folks from out of town. Sometimes it's people who think they could do more than they can.
Right. And heat-related illness can come on suddenly and can result in death. So we just encourage to drink lots of water, avoid being out in the direct sun, and then taking lots of breaks.
So how have you liked the job so far? Did you think it was going to be overwhelming, and has it been?
You know, it's kind of like getting thrown into the deep end of the pool, but it's a lot of fun. And so Will was right. This is like the best job. And, you know, there's a steep learning curve on some things, but on the public health side, that's kind of where I came up. So, you know, people always ask me, how's everything going? I'm like, public health is great.
And you and I are having this conversation, but there's so much that goes on behind the scenes. How important is it at times to keep those separate? I know it can be difficult because the public wants to know. It's a public agency. But does a lot get done behind the scenes that the rest of us just aren't privy to?
There's a lot that goes on in public health to ensure, you know, we always say that people don't know that we're there until there's a thing like a measles outbreak or a flu outbreak. But we are constantly behind the scenes monitoring diseases that are getting diagnosed, watching for death records to see if there are trends, working with federal partners. You know, we're always on conference calls, for example, with Ebola. So we're consulting with federal and international partners to track travelers and follow up with them on a daily basis. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes to ensure that our population stays healthy and well.
Dr. Kara Crist is director of the Arizona Department of Health Services. Thank you for coming in.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about a new economic development effort in the Valley. It's called Velocity. And then later on this hour, Zach Buchanan of the Arizona Republic talks about the Arizona Diamondbacks' first half of the Major League Baseball season. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the Children's Museum of Phoenix, now offering preschool and primary art classes. Art classes information and registration at childrensmuseumofphoenix.org.
And good morning. This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Join us at 1 for News Hour from the BBC, and the world is at 2. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now, sunny sky, 73 degrees in Flagstaff. It's partly sunny and 82 in Prescott, 95 degrees under sunny skies in Casa Grande. It's sunny and 87 in Tucson, 98 degrees in Yuma. Well, KJZZ swag is at our new online store. Now you can show off how much you love KJZZ. From mugs to t-shirts, your purchase helps support your favorite shows. Visit yourshop.kjzz.org. Right now, under mostly sunny skies, it's 98 degrees in Phoenix at 11:22.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Economic development is a point of focus for most, if not all, communities across the country, but for the Valley, perhaps even more so, especially following the Great Recession, when the area's reliance on construction and real estate made it seem as though we simply didn't have enough economic diversity. That brings us to Velocity, which was developed by the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program in tandem with the Greater Phoenix Economic Council. And joining me now to talk about Velocity are Chris Camacho, President and CEO of GPEC, and John Graham, Chairman of Sunbelt Holdings. Gentlemen, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, Chris, tell us about the origin of Velocity. Where did it come from? Who's involved?
Steve, Velocity began about 24 months ago as we were undertaking this work with the Brookings Institution out of D.C., where we were focusing on how do we shift this regional economy away from relying on consumption-based industry and really heavily focusing our efforts towards galvanizing leaders across the public and private sectors to focus on how we build a more advanced, diversified economic base to really insulate ourselves against the boom and bust cycles that we've seen over the last 30, 40 years.
Chris, who are the stakeholders involved? I mean, a lot of people need to be at the table for this, I would think.
Yeah, there's a number of individuals. This actually began with the mayors. There were a number of mayors that were at the table in the beginning. That's now morphed into a number of technology leaders, thought leaders from the post-secondary system, community college network, and a number of CEOs like my colleague here, John, who's really had a successful career in real estate, is now recognizing the more emphasis that we place on exports and advancing the economy, it's going to be better for everyone.
John, real estate, I mentioned in the intro, real estate and construction got a lot of attention in the Valley, and it helped, certainly. I mean, growth was a major part of what was going on here. What about economic diversity appeals to you at this point? And are there certain industries that come to you and say, boy, that's something that the Valley should really be heavily involved in?
Well, there's no question. I've been in the real estate business my entire business career, and so I've seen many of the booms and busts in the Valley, and this last one, I think, was a particularly an eye-opener for everybody in that we had the crash like everybody else, but unlike most times when we were the first to recover, we've really languished this time and have been really the last out of the recovery as far as job growth and a recovery, and we still have not seen the home building industry respond like it normally does. But more than that, I think we really have started to look at kind of what drives our economy, and as Chris said, we were a largely consumption-based economy. I think that pronounces the cyclicality and the ups and downs, and so this has really been a study to see how we can diversify the economy to help it have more gentle ups and downs, but also have the prospect of really growing in an area that I think is our future, which is in innovation and advanced industries, in addition to what normally drives the economy in a very positive way.
I presume you wouldn't be involved if you didn't have optimism about this, as long as people work together and make this go. But people will say, again, we've had the boom and bust cycles before, and some people really benefited from that and enjoyed it. Why do you think this recent recession is the one that's going to get more people on board and say, okay, let's not wait for the next boom. Let's be ready for the next bust instead?
Well, again, I think this was an eye-opener in that it just it was not a traditional pattern of the down and then the up. And I think that candidly, we're at a maturity point in our economic cycle where the things that we aspire to do right now, probably for the first time, are really things that they're natural areas for us to focus on with inherent strengths. And one thing I always try to focus on when I talk about this is I am a very optimistic person. I am very optimistic about the future. I think Phoenix is an amazing place, and Arizona is an amazing place to live. I just think it's a time that when we could look at something that happened that was very negative and focus on how to do things better, more productively, and consciously make an effort, especially for our kids and their kids, to have a better, brighter future.
Chris, are there some industries that come to mind for you that Arizona could be a leader in, the Valley could be a leader in?
Well, I think as you look at regional economies, the 21st century marketplace requires any economy to be advancing itself. And this is as John alluded to, this is an economy that's about 83% jobs recovery from the bottom. Mm-hmm. So we still have a ways to go. And if you look at personal income, we're not seeing the personal income increase at a level that you would hope during the recovery. And so that leaves an opportunity for us where we can accelerate the pathways around biomedical research. Downtown U of A biomedical campus is a great example. Velocity embeds an opportunity for Arizona State University to elevate its engineering school to become world-class. Imagine if we had a Stanford or Georgia Tech or Purdue engineering throughput in our backyard. What would that do to major base industry companies like Boeing and Honeywell or even Raytheon in Tucson that want to advance their investments in research and development here? It would change the equation. And in addition to that, our ability to connect the innovation ecosystem is really important. We're one of the top growth markets for startups in the country. And John and I were talking before we came in the room today. We are a unique region that scales companies or allows companies to scale because of the throughput, labor throughput that we have, the great environment that our legislature's placed, from a regulatory burden perspective. So there's a lot of positive things that are happening. What if we put this market into overdrive? Just imagine what we could be.
Chris, you mentioned the legislature, and you also mentioned ASU, and there are people who are concerned that can something like Velocity succeed in the way you want it to when university community college funding is down? One would think those would be places that are natural incubators for what you're talking about.
So certainly nationally, the trend is we've seen scalebacks in some markets in terms of university and two-year technical funding. You've seen other regions really accelerate their investment. And I think the difference here, what Velocity brings, is a very intentional, a very measured, a very performance-based effort to elevate a particular school, which is the Ira Fulton School, which, you know, ultimately, again, with base industries, their success is going to be predicated on their engineers or their ability to find engineers and grow those engineers. And again, if you look at applied research, probably the best example is Semitech. Semitech in Austin was an anchor catalyst strategy where the federal government placed $100 million of capital. There was a $1.1 billion match that matched the public money that was created. And ultimately what occurred was the commercialization of new technologies around the semiconductor industry. And that's what we'd like to advance around sensors, around biomedical research, and other areas where we have clinical and technology excellence.
John, you brought up the word innovation before, and people will talk about this being the Silicon Desert. And I wonder, is it better to not necessarily compare ourselves to Silicon Valley and focus on what this area does well? Because I think when people hear Silicon Valley, they think, well, Silicon Valley had a decades-long head start. They've got Stanford, they've got Berkeley, they've got et cetera. Do you think it's good to focus on those innovation things without necessarily comparing ourselves at this point to other places?
In general, I totally think that's a good idea. The only thing that's it's hard to with the young adults that are out in the workforce right now is, and I hear these conversations far too often, where they and their friends talk about going to places like Portland and Seattle and the Bay Area and Austin and the usual suspects. And so while I don't think we should try to necessarily exactly emulate them because we are very different, I think we should be in these studies with Brookings and SRI, really looked at what the tools we have here that are unique and special and how to build upon those and not try to wish we were something that is either harder to do or that we're just not going to be able to compete. So the answer is, I think to talk about them as in the same sentence that we're one of those, I'd love to hear that, but I don't think we should have a strategy of trying to emulate an outside market because I think we're enough different that we shouldn't.
The concept of exporting came up. Where does Mexico fit in on this? Mexico has been a major trading partner of Arizona. Chris, is that a partner that can help advance something like Velocity?
Yes, certainly. So I just returned from a trip with the governor. Governor Ducey led a delegation of 40 business leaders to Mexico. Just looking at the numbers, last year we had seen an increase of just over 27% in our trade with Mexico. You're seeing a Mexican economy that's pretty resilient, that's growing the middle class, you know, pretty exponentially, and the consumer base is going to be one that's going to demand products. Now, those products, you know, we hope are produced in Arizona and exported to Mexico. We continue to, you know, import products tied to our maquila, you know, efforts that we've had alignment with the border region. But, you know, again, the emphasis that we've seen out of the governor and certainly our leaders here locally with Mayor Stanton leading an important effort, kind of leading the charge with Mexico, has been how do we ensure that we are getting the appropriate levels of federal investment along the ports or in the ports that are necessary to drive, you know, throughput of goods. And so you've seen Texas and California, neighboring states, very aggressively, really top to bottom federal delegations align with regional and local level, you know, leaders. That's what we want to see for our future alignment with Mexico.
John, go ahead.
And I totally agree with that, but I think the thing that just to overly emphasize is that historically what we've been is a consumption-based economy. We're really good at selling stuff to ourselves, and while that's really good, there's not a multiplier effect on it, and where you really get that catalytic activity is when you export, and the most obvious one to me is Mexico, in that I think that's an area to tremendously grow trade, as well as just trying to be a better regional economy where we even have more trade within the region of even the other states within the United States. So I think these are strategies that are all embedded in Velocity to try to really, as Chris said, to really turbocharge or expand our economy more quickly, because I think a lot of these things might inherently happen. But by doing this, I think we can consciously, can catalytically grow our economy quicker and more healthily, and in a way that it'll be less cyclical in the future.
And Chris, John mentioned that he's an optimist, and I think people have reason to be optimistic here, but economic development always puts people, I think, a little bit on edge because they think, well, are we going to have to go to another state and grab jobs from here? What Velocity seems like it has the concept and the potential to be sort of pioneering in this area, a place that has relied so much on climate, so much on real estate, so much just on growth, people wanting to come here as opposed to being in other places. So can this be a bumpy ride? Should people expect this to be ultimately successful? But getting there, it might be tough because these are things, that, frankly, the area hasn't tried before.
Yeah, Steve, I think these kind of initiatives, they're really momentous from the standpoint that our competitor markets are inducing these kind of strategies. And while we have so many natural advantages on climate, on proximal distance, to the ports, to people wanting to live here, people moving here, affordability, all of those are important attributes of the market. At the same time, our peers in Seattle, our peers in Denver, Chicago, and elsewhere are creating velocity-type programs that are, again, intending on diversifying their own economic bases around what they are, what they have inherent strengths in. That's where we are today. We're going to take this positive momentum that we have, accelerate the positive momentum, and the outcome will be a significant number of high-wage jobs that will drive other indirect jobs as well.
John, final thoughts?
Yeah, I think, again, I said it before, but this is it's something that takes time. It's a marathon, not a sprint. But I think, again, the time is right. We have the alignment of the right leaders, I think, at the right places. I think we've got a great governor that really gets it. And I think that he, as the CEO of the state, can be an enormous contributor to this type of effort. And so, again, I think we're all very, very hopeful with the infrastructure that's falling into place.
John Graham is chairman of Sunbelt Holdings. Chris Camacho is president and CEO of GPAC. We've been talking about Velocity. Gentlemen, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The politics of immigration are back in the front seat as the presidential race starts to move into high gear. Last weekend, reality TV star and Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump was in Phoenix, continuing with his controversial comments about Mexico and border security. A number of Republicans have tried to distance themselves from Trump, and Democrats have criticized him openly. So how important an issue will immigration be in the presidential campaign? Will comprehensive immigration reform return to the discussion? With me to talk about those possibilities is Luis DeCipio, a professor of political science and Chicano Latino studies at the University of California, Irvine. Professor, welcome. Thanks for joining us. How significant an issue do you expect immigration to be in 2016 in the presidential campaign?
I think we'll see a comparable level of attentiveness to immigration as in 2008 and 2012, meaning we'll see a lot of discussion of it in the primaries, particularly on the Republican side. And then depending on who the nominee is on the Republican side, we may see some interest in the general election as well.
Did there seem to be a lessening of momentum when it came to this issue because maybe cooler heads were prevailing and the emotional aspects of it, which are usually reignited during a campaign, are now coming about?
I think that President Obama tried to come up with sort of a stopgap solution with the executive actions. Those, however, have been held up by the courts, so they're not really helping very much. And I think Donald Trump has reinvigorated the conversation on the right about immigration and shown the Republican candidates that they need positions and they need to be speaking to that Republican base that's still very upset about immigration.
Will this help Republicans? Will it help Democrats in the sense that they are at least now forced to come up with an alternative to what Trump is saying, and it may actually make them look more even-handed on the issue?
I'm not altogether sure that's going to be the dynamic of the Republican primaries, at least the early states, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina. The Republican voters in those states take very strident positions, actually positions somewhat comparable to Mr. Trump's. So it will be the exceptional Republican candidate that will be able to skate around that and keep himself viable or herself, if it's Carly Fiorina, until the general election, when they will need to take a more moderate position. So it's not. I don't see that moderation coming out of the Republican Party right now.
What intrigues me the most, though, is even if it is not moderation per se, and people who support comprehensive reform or think that should be the issue, at least if they're emphasizing border security, it's about there actually is potentially a plan as opposed to just the rhetoric or ads that make us become scared of immigrants, basically.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. There is a plan. The Senate passed a bill in 2006. It passed similar, though a little bit more restrictive bill in 2013, and a number of the candidates in the race have endorsed that proposal either in 2006 or 2013. So the outline of the solution is there. The problem rests, of course, in the House of Representatives and then in the Republican base that prevent moderation from occurring.
As it stands right now, and this is early, and I know certainly public radio listeners are not fans of hearing about the horse race. They want to hear more about the issues. But at this point, because we're sort of in the early part of the horse race, if we think about the front runners, particularly on the Republican side, is there anyone in there that you think will approach this in a really thoughtful way? I mean, is Jeb Bush that person? Are the lesser candidates at this point, someone like Lindsey Graham, is he someone who will talk about that, but probably won't get enough traction to really make it an issue anyway?
Yeah, I think both are right. I think Jeb Bush has been the one that has taken the most thoughtful and most comfortable positions with moving forward towards immigration reform. Marco Rubio did early in his Senate service, but then I think reading the tea leaves on the Republican base and maybe thinking forward to a presidential election has moved a little bit to the right on that. Certainly Chris Christie and Scott Walker initially took moderate positions on immigration, but they too have moved to the right. So Jeb Bush is the one that sort of stands out as at least being sensitive to the needs of immigrants as part of a larger solution. Lindsey Graham, one of the Gang of Eight, became Gang of Seven when Marco Rubio dropped out. But I think you're absolutely right that he's not going to be able to force a conversation about immigration into the Republican primary debates. One, I guess, if I'm looking down the road, not horse race, but sort of towards the general election, I think one way in which immigration or the broader concern with incorporating Latinos into the political debate might play out as a consideration on either the Republican side or the Democratic side, or both, maybe, to think about a Latino as a vice presidential nominee. And certainly the pool is a little bit wider on the Republican side with potentially Marco Rubio if he doesn't get the nomination, potentially Susana Martinez, the governor of New Mexico. On the Democratic side, Julian Castro comes to mind. So, there are potentials for both parties if they want to make a symbolic statement of outreach to Latinos, which would bring the immigration debate into the general election in a different sort of way.
Is there any reason to think that a candidate with a Latino or Hispanic background like Marco Rubio or even Ted Cruz have any more credibility on this issue, or will they be perceived as having more credibility simply based on their background?
It would depend on how they presented themselves. I mean, I don't think Ted Cruz would, because he has taken positions that are antithetical to the Latino community on immigration. Marco Rubio has tried to play both sides of the fence and could certainly, in a general election, rediscover his desire for compromise and a comprehensive solution. So it isn't simply being Latino that gives you credibility. It's being Latino and speaking to the concerns of the Latino community and then integrating those into the broader political debates of the era.
Is immigration an issue you expect to once again put more Latino or Hispanic voters in the Democratic camp? And are there any factors that could change that? Is there that legitimacy of someone like Jeb Bush actually taking a serious look at the issue? Or is this one where there's going to be, we have expectations of so much rhetoric in the Republican primaries that it'll be hard to turn that by November?
Exactly. I mean, that's the problem that each of the last two Republican nominees has faced. John McCain, who was truly a leader on immigration reform, had to back away from his own positions and then couldn't reestablish his credibility in the general election. Governor Romney never got over the self-deportation line that I think he used defensively in a debate, but it came to be the way he was understood in among immigrant advocates and Latino voters. The nature of the primary debate on the Republican side this time, I think, will be as vitriolic as 2008 and 2012, and that makes it hard for any Republican nominee to move forward from that.
Luis DeCipio is a professor of political science and Chicano Latino studies at the University of California at Irvine. Professor, thank you for squeezing us in.
Oh, my pleasure.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll look back at the Arizona Diamondbacks' first half of the Major League Baseball season. They're doing a lot better than they did in 2014. Plus, we'll talk with Valley actress and playwright Kathy Dresbach. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Changing Hands Bookstore, now open in Central Phoenix on the light rail at 3rd Avenue and Camelback, where you can enjoy beer, wine, and coffee while you read at First Draft Book Bar. ChangingHands.com.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and online at KJZZ.org. Well, partly to mostly sunny skies in the valley forecast for today. Another warm one. We're expecting a high today of 108 degrees. That's right around average, which is 107. Partly cloudy skies overnight, a low near 86, and mostly sunny skies tomorrow, 106 again for the high. Join us at 12 for NPR's Here and Now. U.S. veterans are given the chance to go to school on the GI Bill. But a new report says there are 2,000 schools receiving taxpayer dollars that aren't accredited and don't lead to employment for veterans. And the International Monetary Fund is raising more questions about Greece's debt. Here and Now from Boston starts at noon. Right now, with 26% relative humidity, it's mostly sunny and 98 degrees in Phoenix at 11:44.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In 2014, the Arizona Diamondbacks had the worst record in Major League Baseball, and many observers weren't overwhelmed by the team's chances of improving on that this season, even with a number of personnel changes. But the team has been competitive and currently resides in third place in the National League West. Zach Buchanan covers the Diamondbacks for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central Sports and joins me now. Zach, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. So how much of the Diamondbacks' improvement this season has to do with better management structure or better talent evaluation?
That's a good question. I think, ironically, after their 281 and 81 seasons leading into last season, they kind of bet that their core was competitive and would not result in that horrible season last year, and they were wrong. But I think a lot of the reason they're doing so well this year is essentially the core of players they had from last year's team. It's being powered by Paul Goldschmidt and A.J. Pollock. Many of the guys in the bullpen are the same. The big difference is the rotation, and that hasn't exactly been their engine for success. They've got a lot of new pitchers there, but a lot of them have been very up and down. So I think a lot of it is just them kind of regressing back to – or maybe not regressing, but going back to normal. I think last year was a bit of an aberration.
When it comes to the starting rotation and the pitchers that they've got, not to use a baseball term that's negative, but it does seem like they're sort of spitballing it. They're sort of just saying, all right, let's give some of these young guys a try because we've tried some of the veterans who weren't that good, because it seems like there's a lot of inconsistency there. From start to start, you're not sure what you're going to get.
I think that's a part of it. That's certainly why they brought up Alan Webster. He's since gone back down to AAA, but then when they brought him up in mid-June, it was to see, they basically said, this is the time for us to see what we've got in these young guys that we traded for. Some of them have performed reasonably well. Robbie Gray has been fantastic. Ruby De La Rosa has had his very strong stretches, although he seems to fall back into these less strong stretches. And so they've had their successes there. It's just on a start-to-start basis, you're not quite sure what you're going to get. And you know, the key to a good rotation is that every time you go out, you have an expectation to win, which doesn't seem to be the case right now. But they have interesting pieces that you wonder what could happen if they finally kind of gel together.
The Valley has a reputation of liking teams that, you know, win certainly, but are also really exciting to watch. Is this team an exciting team to watch? I mean, is this a team that fans can really get behind, or do they need to work on that in addition to getting wins as well?
I think they're exciting to watch. I think it's a question of how closely you pay attention. I mean, if you go to the Diamondbacks game, you're going to see a team that can hit homers, that can take the extra base, that is very prolific at stealing bases. They've got one of the best players in the major leagues in Paul Goldschmidt. There are definitely plenty of exciting things to watch. You just have to care enough to pay that much attention. And I think after last season, the fan base has kind of taken a show-me-you're-for-real attitude a little bit. And the Diamondbacks are doing their best to answer that. But I think if they can stay in the playoff conversation into August or September, then people will start getting on board a little more.
For people who follow the sport closely, there were a couple of what are called salary dumps, sort of, when they traded Mark Trumbo to Seattle, although they've gotten some, at least their catcher, Wellington Castillo, has played well for the Diamondbacks since they got him. But then there was that other sort of odd one where veteran starting pitcher Bronson Arroyo, who's been hurt, was traded along with who is considered a top pitching prospect, and basically just to be able to dump the $10 million or so left on Arroyo's salary. Should there be concern among Diamondbacks fans that this team doesn't have what it takes financially to compete?
I don't think so. I think a lot of the moves they've made over the last year, going back to when Tony La Russa was brought on, have been to clear some of these unnecessary contracts and big financial commitments. And they've done a lot of that. I mean, they got Chicago to take all $40 million of Miguel Montero's salary. They got the Yankees, of course, now the Marlins, to take on Martin Prado and the $25 million left on his. I think they're trying to do their best to shed the dead weight so they can have the maximum amount of financial flexibility to make a move if they feel like they need a piece to stay competitive. Now, that trade raised a lot of eyebrows in the baseball community just because it seemed to so very greatly undercut what that pitching prospect, Touki Toussaint's, you know, real value would have been on an open market. But kind of depending on what you think of that, and it's not an exact science to figure out what these guys are worth, and Touki could easily flame out. The reputation of the history of high school right-handers taken in the first round of the draft is not a sterling one. But most people are wondering if they got maximum value for that. But I think the instinct to try and get rid of these kind of albatross contracts that they're saddled under is a good one. The question you have is whether they're doing it in the most effective way.
And, Zach, final question for you. What kind of expectations do you have for the rest of the way? They got pitcher Patrick Corbin back. He's pitched a couple of times since he had the Tommy John surgery. If the team stays healthy, do you think they have a wild card run in them? Do you think they could scare the Dodgers in the NL West?
I would think it'd be pretty difficult to catch the Dodgers, and I think the Giants are also ahead of them in that race. And then the difficult thing with the wild card race is there are a lot of teams between them and a wild card spot right now. So while there may only be a manageable number of games back from that, there are a lot of other things that have to go the other way for them to make it. I think they can definitely stay in that conversation. I think they'll remain as competitive as they've been to this point of the season, if not a little more, because getting Patrick Corbin back can only help them. And they may have the ability to make a move at the deadline that will make them a little more solid as a team. But it's a very much an uphill battle to get to the playoffs. There's just a lot of teams that they have to step over.
Zach Buchanan covers the Arizona Diamondbacks for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central Sports. Zach, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Actress Kathy Dresbach has been on Valley stages for decades, playing a huge variety of roles. She's also known for being part of the cast of the iconic Wallace and Ladmo show. And now she's part of the Peoria-based Theater Works New Works Westival, featuring local playwrights. Dresbach's show Three No Trump will be on stage this Saturday night at 7:30 and Sunday afternoon at 2. And Kathy joins me in studio. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So you've been an actress for a long time. Have you written plays before?
Well, I have written plays before. In fact, Theater Works is no stranger to new works. When David Woe was running the joint when they first opened 30 years ago, he and I would collaborate on kid shows primarily. He would write the music, I write the book, Snow White and the Seven Misfits, and now a word from our sponsor, and of course, Badgers. We don't need no stinking Badgers.
So, now that you're writing on your own, I presume?
Yes.
Three No Trump was written by yourself.
Yes.
What's it like? What's it like to, are you writing for yourself? Are you writing for, does it give you that insight as a playwright to write better for actors and actresses?
Well, this project is a little bit unique. It's kind of a labor of love for me because it's all based on a true story. Yeah. It sprang from my mother's bridge club. These ladies have been playing cards together twice a month, rain or shine, for 50 years.
Wow.
And about 20 years into the process, they started keeping a journal, a collective journal. It would move from hostess to hostess to hostess, and she would write what's going on. And now there are 7 volumes, 30 years worth of journaling from the ladies of the club. So that was my source material for Three No Trump.
Wow. So what sort of journals, based on stories they'd tell each other, based on what?
Well, just based on everything and based on nothing. It's sort of a slice of life chat fest. They would write about the grandkids and what jobs they have and retirement and dating and divorce and who died and who got a haircut, you know?
Yeah. Now, because I was wondering about the origin of this, because my folks play bridge. They taught me how to play bridge. Uh-huh. Most people my age did not play bridge. It's not necessary. So three no Trump. Explain what the title means.
Well, that's a bid in bridge. Three no Trump would equal a game. If you're playing a contract in no Trump, there is no Trump suit. Mm. So it means it's a game. It's a game in bridge.
You've done comedy. You've done tragedy. You've done heavy drama. Where does three no Trump fit on that scale?
It's definitely a sitcom. Writing comedy is what I know best. I wrote sketch comedy for Wallace and Ladmo for many years. Mm-hmm. So the challenge here was to take, you know, what I'm used to doing, 90-second sketches, and make it into a full-length play. But it's lucky that the bridge ladies are funny, and they gave me a lot of material to draw from.
So what kind of humor are we talking about? Because people today are into ironic humor, they're into snarkiness. Is there a part of that in there or no?
I would not call them snarky.
Okay.
They're really nice. That was part of the challenge as well. Where do we find some conflict among these ladies who are so nice to each other? But it's just situation, everyday life comedy,
You
know.
And the dialogue can be tough to write, even with a comedy, because you want there to be some level of realism there. Mm-hmm. Was that a challenge for you?
Well, writing for me is always a challenge, but, you just keep putting pencil to paper, and eventually, hopefully, something comes out that's worth saying out loud.
So it's a new work. As we said, you've got it from your mom's journals and her other fellow bridge players.
Right.
How long has this been really brewing for you to actually write a play about it?
I'd say I've been working on it for a little over a year.
That doesn't seem that bad, actually.
Yeah.
Unless you've been writing all night and maybe you've been doing that, getting yourself up.
I would write a little, leave it, come back to it, and finally just started to gel a little bit. And now we have something to present, and I hope the audience finds it funny, because I find it funny. We had our first read-through last night. We have quite the little powerhouse of actresses performing, including Maria Amorocho, Sherry Watts, Katie McFadden, Lisa Fogel, Jody Weiss, and Jan Sandwich, and Deborah K. Stevens is directing.
A lot of names of people who are theatergoers in the Valley would have heard before,
absolutely.
Certainly. What is this community like as far as being a professional like you are? This is a place where there's a lot of interesting theater around, but we've had companies go under, we've had fewer opportunities, and you've been doing this for quite a while. I mean, is this, it's obviously your home, but is it a place where an actress can thrive?
I think you just called me old.
No, did not. You started young. We saw you on Wallace and Ladmo.
Yes.
You were young.
Yeah. Yes, I think Phoenix is a place where actresses, where any artist can thrive. It's a little more difficult to carve out a niche, in this market, but it's a trade-off. The people who decide to stay in Phoenix and make their living as artists have to cobble together a career. You know, sometimes you're an actress, and sometimes you're a director, and sometimes you're a writer, and sometimes you're painting the sets in between jobs. So it's just, it's difficult, but it's challenging, and it's worthwhile to stay in Phoenix because the quality of life here is so great.
It's worked for you, and I wonder if someone were a 20-year-old Kathy, is this something you would have advised 20-year-old Kathy to stick with in this area? Because it's obviously a huge passion, and we always hear about, you know, you really need to do what you love to excel at it and also
sure.
be able to sleep at night.
Yeah. Well, I guess I didn't really have a career plan. I just sort of take things as they come, and I've been one of the lucky ones that a lot of things have come my way, and I've been able, been at the right place in the right time, and hallelujah for that.
Well, one of the right places was, at least from afar, was being on Wallace and Ladmo,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people saw you on that. Do people still come up and ask you about that? I mean, I'm someone who watched Wallace and Ladmo as a kid. I mean, is that, and is that, do you have fond memories of doing that?
I absolutely. It was the best job I ever had. I have very fond memories, and people, I was at a function, a party, in fact, on Sunday night, and met a group there that I didn't know, but they knew of Wallace and Ladmo, and they were native Arizonans, and we had a big old conversation about that. Yes, so people do remember the show. They
did they ask you to do voices?
Sometimes. But you don't.
I won't ask you to do that. I mean, I wanted to, Kathy. So on a program like that, which was, it was appealing to kids, of course, but it had that tone where it was clearly supposed to appeal to, it was never a lowest common denominator show. It was always about making people think. Again, what was that like being a part of something where it wasn't just like, okay, we're going to be silly and try to be obvious. We're going to really try to make people think.
Well, that's what made it fun to be a part of, that you actually got to be creative on an adult level, even though it was a kid's show. And many, many, many adults tuned in every day and appreciated the humor. Much of it was drawn from, you know, the pages of the newspaper and local current events. And so, yeah, that was a great deal of fun and very satisfying creatively.
So you wrote Three No Trump. Are you working on anything else? Do you like that view? Do you want to go back to doing more writing?
We'll see how this goes. We have audiences on Saturday night and Sunday afternoon, as you mentioned. We are adding a Sunday 5 o'clock show because the matinee is sold out. So this is all just part of the creative process. We'll have a talk back with the audience after they see the reading, and based on their feedback, the play will shape a little bit differently, perhaps, and we'll see how it goes.
Actress and playwright Kathy Dresbach. We've been talking about her show, Three No Trump, which, as Kathy mentioned, is this afternoon, Saturday night at 7:30, Sunday afternoon at 2, and then an additional show. It's also the 30th anniversary of Theater Works in Peoria. Thank you for being here, Kathy.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. If you want to hear any of our segments again or you missed a previous program, go online this afternoon to kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone.